you take, let us assume, a third toke, long and slow, you vaporize, and you take it in and in and in, and there is a sound like the crumpling of a plastic bread wrapper, or the crackling or the flame, or the and a tone, and a tone, a
Alright, you're listening to Kidney Co-op Radio 93.5 FM, CJLY. We're broadcasting live from Nelson and on the World Wide Web, kidneycoopradio.com.
There is a cheer. The gnomes have learned a new way to say hooray.
Alright, welcome listeners. This is Fane of the Cosmos, Infinite Moment, and I'm your host, Dustin Sunflower. And happy Father's Day to all fathers out there. I was at a lacrosse tournament today with my son, and it was pretty wild being in the amateur dad zone, amateur sports dad zone, and the bleachers, like, come on, go, 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 you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, it's blessed to be a father, that's for sure. And I'm going to play a song right after this for all fathers. Now, last week, we interviewed Jay and Autumn, who are now known as Hetz and Aviva. And we had Nadeev in the studio also. And that was one of the hardest interviews I've ever had to do as a radio show host. It really was hard on my spirit, hard on my body. And we had a special guest in the studio with us at that time, Daryl, and due to factors of time and just the way things went, he didn't really get to express what he wanted to express. And after the kind of last jab that Nadeev made at the end of the show, I think it only fitting that we hear from Daryl. And let me just put it this way. You, as a radio show host, you do a radio. I'm just in the room here with mics, and it goes out and is broadcast around. It goes into people's ears, and the thought goes in their brains, and they think about things. And then they approach you if they have... If what they've heard has affected them, they approach you. And this week, I had more people than I've ever had approach me and ask me to look into this deeper and make time to find out more about the 12 tribes. And since then, I've talked with people from across the states and in our own community, and we will keep this on the burner because it's very important that we look at it openly, honestly, and, you know, this is our community. It's very important that we focus in on these things. Like, we make sure we know what's going on. So, we will be talking after the break. Let me just look at my schedule here. Okey-doo, and we might have a... We're going to probably talk to Tamara from Flix about the upcoming movie Escape to Canada, and the kind of... It's funny, a movie comes out and already Stephen Harper's quick at dismantling all of those freedoms. So this is going out to all fathers, and especially fathers with daughters. It seems like a father who has a daughter, But anyway, this song is so beautiful, and I played it on the radio show before, but this is such a beauty song, and I'm gonna dedicate it out to Alan, because he has a daughter, a red-haired daughter who is very fine. So here we go. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
One. One is long and one is short. One is thin and one is stout. In the morning when they wake, only one's breakfast can I make. One dances and knows how many squares hopscotch ought to have. One goes wah, 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 ha, ha, wah, wah. One won't eat anything much, I guess she lives on air and sun and noodles. One's beginning to learn that the milk is over there, inside of that shirt, beneath the blue eyes of the woman I love. I'm a man who's rich in daughters, and if by some wild chance I get rich in money, like say another 2,000 a year, or even 1,000 a year, I'm gonna look into having some more daughters. Daughter who is tall now was not so tall. One night we were driving home in the truck, and I was sad because I was busted and disgusted. And she looked out the window and said, Dad, the moon is coming home with us. She said, Dad, the moon is coming home with us. I'm a man who's rich in daughters, and if by some wild chance I get rich in money, like another 2,000 a year, or even 1,000 a year, I'm gonna look into having some more daughters. Magic the house. The one that can walk walks in warm and still dreaming to give me a hug or ask why it's so cold, or why is there school? Why it's so cold, or why is there school? And the one who can't walk or talk, it just lies in bed and laughs. She just lies in bed and laughs. I'm a man who's rich in daughters, and if by some wild chance I get rich in money, like another 2,000 a year, or even 1,000 a year, I'm gonna look into having some more daughters.
Welcome back. That was Greg Brown, Daughters. Oh, love it. So, in the studio, I have Daryl and Walter. And I didn't meet Daryl in person. I met his music first, because I lived in a basement apartment of this house that it just so happened that his piano happened to be right above my room. And all I remember one night is laying in bed with my girlfriend at the time, and I think you played Debussy.
It was Ravel.
Okay.
Close though.
There I am in bed while this piano is playing right above, and it was like music raining down from the ceiling. And that was the first time, like, who is this guy? And so, Daryl, like, what? How long have you been in the Coots for?
I've been in the Kootenays for about 20 years now.
Right on. And what do you do? I think you do something with music.
Well, I'm an artist by vocation, and my creative disciplines have been classical piano performance, playwriting and producing plays, performing in them. And I'm currently working on my art documentary feature film called The Naked Queen. And we're just in the process of doing the final cut. And we hope to do a screening for the public here in our community in the fall of this year.
Now, didn't your brother play this weekend?
Yeah, my brother Paul, he just played a concert at the Capitol Theater, and it was the last three sonatas of Beethoven, and he has a theory going on that seems to be bringing a lot of attention to him, and his career's getting a major boost right now.
Nice.
Yeah.
Now, Walter, I know you from Bhutto.
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 Yes, yes. Yeah, well, it's I'm part of the moving center. I was Lynn's partner when she first started it, and I started it with her, and then it became, as it is now, a cooperative, and I've done Bhutto dance, other kinds of dance performance. But basically, I'm just a layperson in the community with a lot of interest in the arts.
I know. I can tell, like, you both have the twinkle. You know, and when you see it in town, you're like, ah, yes, it's one of the fine folks. So, we had you in the studio last week, Daryl, and the last note was kind of was a dismissal by Nadiv saying, he didn't go very deep, or words to the like. And at the time, I wish I'd kind of stood up to him more and been like, hey, you know, no personal attacks or no, you know, like, because you sat in here,
right?
You didn't jump in, you didn't interrupt, you didn't say anything that was derogatory, inflammatory, you didn't attack, there was no personal attacks, and so I felt that comment was kind of offhand, but I'm glad that you're here to be able to talk about it. And for listeners who don't know, it's very, very intense kind of situation being in tight quarters with that kind of, I don't know what kind of, like, how would you describe that vibration? Or actually, no, let's not go there first. Let's go back a few years and see, when did you, what is your experience in intentional communities? Like, why were you even interested in 12 Tribes? Like, what is your interest behind intentional communities or spiritual communities? Like, how did you get started in that?
Okay, I've been, one of my main studies and areas of research that I bring into my work is deep ecology, and also depth psychology, and a comparative study of spiritual traditions, with kind of an emphasis on the esoteric side of those traditions. Like, for example, Gnosticism and the Essenes for Christianity, the Sufis for Islam, the Taoists for Buddhism, and so on. So my studies in deep ecology really brought out, you know, defined where our culture is sitting right now from historical perspectives, and the kind of situation that is somewhat hazardous, you might say. We all know that we've got many great problems going on globally. The earth is in trouble in terms of the environment and so on. And my question became a very profound question that I really needed to find the answer to. And that led me into a study of communities. How have communities in the past, what was it in their culture that was able to keep them in a sustainable way of life? Mm-hmm. And that means an ongoing passing from generation to generation in an environment that's being sustained and can sustain that human community. So I studied the communities network. I went on, you know, got all the books I could get to read about communities and what holds them together, mythology, the kinds of beliefs that people have that help them to stay together. And about 4 to 5 years ago, the tribes people, the 12 tribes, sent out a couple of sentinels, you might say, from Winnipeg to scout this area as a possible area to open up another chapter, you might call it, of their community.
Why do you think they sent them here? Did they say at the time, or?
I don't think that they really said to me. I mean, maybe they heard something. I mean, there's something about this area. It's a special area. Nelson's the Queen City. It's absolutely beautiful here. You know, we've got amazing a natural environment around us. We're far away from all the cities, really, and it exudes a kind of, you know, it's gotten into the collective here for British Columbia, for sure. Mm-hmm. People talk about the Kootenays. You know, there's many special features mm-hmm. to it.
So they came here and you happened to meet up with them, or?
Well, interestingly enough, I have a property, a co-op that we formed, a land co-op, Mulvey Creek Land Co-op, and that's situated in the Little Slocan Valley at the base of the Valhalla Park. We got 620 acres back about 12 years ago, and that's where we were doing our own experiment with community and trying to live sustainably and giving a, you know, for me it was my first crack at trying to be practical about it and learn the lessons that you learn by, you know, jumping in feet first.
Yeah.
Well, it just so happened that two of the tribe members came out there and introduced themselves. Now, how they found out about us is a bit of a mystery to me. I guess they asked around and heard about us, and that was the first contact. And I ended up spending some time with them that particular week in the Slocan Valley at some mutual friends, and started to hear their story, you know, and where they were coming from.
Yeah,
yeah.
And now, is that the Little Slocan's right next to the Valhallas, right?
That yeah, we border the Valhallas, and, you know, interestingly enough, it's somewhat mythological, right?
Yeah, the Valhalls, the Norse gods reside there looking over the valley.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, you had a meeting with them, and then did they just left?
Oh, well, they indicated that they, you know, had a strong interest in the area, and that the people they were meeting, including me and friends of mine and people that I know, they felt that this area was ripe, you know, for them, that it was it was kind of a destined thing, and that they were being led here, you know, by their master Yahshua, who was it's the Hebrew word for Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And that they felt it was their calling and so on to come here and open up a community. And sure enough, you know, it was, I think, 6 months later, they were here and started their operations.
Wow. So, what, you're, like, there's their adventure, they send out sentinels and began, but you had already started on your community. How has that community gone on?
The community has gone on. Of course, it's gone through some, you know, radical changes, and you know, you gain a lot of knowledge by going through the actual experience, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that led me further into the studies of depth psychology and eco-psychology, you know, which is really a branch of the deep ecology, to really understand, you know, how is it that mythology affects us? You know, how is it that a group of people believing in something together, how does that constellate to activate certain kinds of behavior?
Mm-hmm.
So that brought me into a deeper study of Jungian psychology to look at how these patterns happen and how they fall apart, at what point, and how do people in those situations handle crises and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a really, you know, immediate interest to follow the course and to get to know this 12 tribes that was coming into our community. Because I knew they were coming in as a collective, as a group, as a religious group. And I knew that would have an impact, you know, on the on our environment, on our community.
Yep.
Yeah.
For sure. Did you find in your experience with the community you worked in that you needed to explore these kind of deeper psychological and these archetypal kind of consciousnesses because of the difficulties we have in our culture of getting together and getting stuff done? Like, did you did you go into it trying to figure out how to make it work?
Well,
like how to make a group of people together and make it work? Like,
well, yeah, and we went in naively, of course, but what there was something that really brought us together, and it did have a spiritual core to it, and it was really connected with the native traditions of North America. And I'm speaking about the Native American Church. We ended up having a lot of connections with spiritual elders from various tribes, both in Canada and the United States, that ended up coming out to the land, talked to us a lot about what that land meant, where we were in history as well, and what it is to for those people who have been exploited, exterminated, marginalized, demonized, and so on, where their spiritual tradition comes from, and that they're living carriers of that tradition. And what they really brought to us was the depth of prayer, you know, the depth of petition, and the immense humility that those people bring to a sacred ritual. And you know, in the course of time, it wasn't just the Native American Church. It turned out, you know, people, shamans from, you know, from Venezuela, the Amazon jungles, and so on, were finding their way to our land and sharing their rituals with us. I mean, it was 12 years of an incredible exploration in a very practical way with Native tribes of our culture.
Right on. Yeah. I was there at some point. And it was for healing for my mom, who was she had cancer. And so, and the experience for me is one of the like most powerful experiences. And it was with one of the elders who came up.
Oh yeah,
for sure, it was incredible. So, how did you reconnect with the 12 tribes? 6 months later, they're getting set up. How did you, like, how did that come to be that you kind of were on the same, not path again, but that you met up again with them?
You know, there's some kind of synchronicity involved. You know, like attracts like, maybe, or there's a certain magnetism that goes on that draws people who have, you know, similar interests at heart together. You know, we want to communicate. We want to share our ideas. I felt that they're a sincere group. I mean, they definitely are motivated by a very, you know, strong and powerful belief. I honor that. You know, and I have a corresponding belief. I have a corresponding sincerity about, you know, finding real answers to the dilemmas of our time. And so, yeah, we somehow magnetized into the same spaces and started, you know, kept going, you know, or brought back the communications. And, you know, we showed each other really an interest. They seemed interested in where I was coming from and what I was doing, kind of like maybe my place in the community here. And I took an interest in them because they are a group. They have, you know, fairly significant numbers. And they're doing things that I could see are corresponding to providing certain answers to some of the questions that I was asking.
There was a resonance,
and I knew that, you know, okay, you guys have been hanging together here for 35 years, and you've been building this up, and they're able to articulate what I call a mythology. They just call it, you know, their truth, the truth of Yahshua and that mythology. And so I knew that there was a great power there. All communities, all spiritual traditions are held together by a very powerful archetypal mythology. And, you know, anthropologists and depth psychologists and the deep ecology movement, We now know that if you want to take, you know, a nation apart, you basically kill their mythology. If you take their mythology away, the community falls apart. And so we know that much. So what I wanted to really find out is, you know, what are the constituents here of this? What are the ingredients of this mythology that's holding these people together? And I just had a real genuine interest to find out.
And so did you Did you approach them with the idea of just asking them questions about their core beliefs, or did you actually want to immerse yourself within the community to see how it worked? Like, you weren't going there like I am, like as a journalist or a reporter, to say, hey, what makes it work? What are your teachings? How does this work? You went in with more, like, what was your kind of...
Well, I mean, in a certain way, it was more personalistic, although it corresponds to my, in a sense, my research, because I want to share, I guess, in the sense of my vocation, I feel like I'd like to be playing a part in the destiny of forming the new paradigm that seems to be emerging. But I had I wasn't out to report anything. I didn't feel like I needed to expose anything to anyone else. It was surely my own personal interest, my own attraction to what they were doing. And it was all very sweet and innocent.
Earnest and genuine.
Earnest and genuine. I wasn't at all thinking like, oh, here's this group that I really feel like I'm going to join, you know, right away. I don't hold that, because I've been involved in a spiritual lineage since I'm 15 years old. I've been a practitioner of that lineage, and you know, really that lineage, because of the nature of it and its own system, allows, you know, its participants to really explore all other lineages.
It's not attached to one.
No, not at all. We honor the true lineages that are, you know, have been articulated in the various cultures of the planet.
So how did you get it? Like, how did you join in the community then?
Okay, well, first of all, let me correct you. I never did really join, because...
No, but I mean, like, join in them in the sense of, like, going through daily routines or, like...
Well, you're speaking about the time that I actually lived there for 2 weeks.
Yes.
Yeah, that was after 4 years of a lot of visits.
Okay.
A lot of strong debates.
Okay.
You know, where we were debating, you know, spiritual ideas.
All right.
Where I was really learning. That's where I was really learning about the deeper aspects of their, what I call, again, their mythology. And they were learning about mine.
Okay.
There were some very heated debates. There were times where I felt I had to get up and go.
I just want listeners to know that this wasn't just like you went there for 2 weeks and then came back. Like, it was a journey. Like,
definite journey. And, you know, after last week when I left and Nadeev made his remarks and I heard about that, you know, I called Nadeev back, and the idea that I'd only come there for 2 weeks and I wasn't willing to go deep. I mean, really, it's quite the contrary. I wanted to go very deep. You know, when you approach these things, you have to approach these things with sincerity if you're going to be able to maintain integrity and honesty. If you're going to join a group, I believe that one has to ask very serious questions, very deep questions. If you're joining a community that requires you to give up everything that you've worked for in your life, your money, your property, you know, in perhaps your values and your former belief systems, you better be asking some really, really tough questions.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a very strong thing to do. And if you're not convinced and had those answers adequately, I mean, those questions adequately answered, it may be a time where you wake up and you're in shock, because you didn't have those questions answered, and all of a sudden you do, you know, and you've signed away your life, you know. This is something that I really would like to talk about here, because, you know, these folks are in the community, and the 2 weeks that I did spend there, I'd like to share some particulars about that story that'll shed light on, you know, the deeper layers that are actually going on that, you know, the community is certainly not going to hear about in their face-to-face, community to our community exchanges.
Okay, yeah, definitely. We need to hear this. And Walter, anytime you want to jump in, we're all equal in this room right now. There's three mics and three spirits, so we're just all... I'm curious, you know, like I want to know more, so...
Yeah, okay, fine. Thanks, Justin. I'm happy just to let Daryl go on and fill us in on his insights.
Well, I asked Walter to join us, as you know, Dustin, because Walter, first of all, is a very, very dear friend of mine, and I share my you know, thoughts, feelings, and friendship with him, like he does with me. And I wanted him here because we've discussed this a fair bit, and I'd really like the listeners to know that it wasn't that I wanted to come on because I've got, you know, an axe to grind, or, you know, I want to get back in some kind of way for an injustice that may have happened. It's because, you know, with people, I know a lot of people in this community because I've been a performer. I've been involved in community things, and, you know, since 9/11 and the Bush administration, I've been involved in demonstrations and different groups, you know. And so I've gotten to know a lot of people in this area, and I love this community. And like I said, you know, to the 12 tribes, people are going to be asking me, you know, what happened,
yeah.
You know, and when they ask me, I got to tell them, you know, it's just that's part of my spiritual tradition is, you know, you just have to tell the truth and be honest, and people ask you, you know, you answer. And now, you know, people have come forward because more experiences are happening with people. They've really asked me to come out and put it out to the public. So I just want to say that, you know, Walter's also been very encouraging, you know, and really helping me to be clear that we have a responsibility. You know, when you know something, it comes with some responsibility, and I hope that I'm able to, you know, say what I have to say in a way that's not meant to be an attack on them, not to, you know, deride them in any, you know, sort of vengeful kind of way or anything like that. I simply want to say what my experience was, and I want to put a perspective on it that really comes from the depth psychology, you know, part of my studies, because Carl Jung had a lot to say about group psychology, the collective unconscious, you know, archetypes like the shadow and so on. And we have a clear example of this kind of thing going on here.
Let's go for a quick music break, and then we'll come right back in when we're fresh. Walter, I think you're a stellar dude. No, I think you're a stellar person. Like, honestly, in the time that I met you and with the Bhutto and everything, like, I'm glad you're here.
Great. Yeah, thank you, Dustin. Yeah.
We're going to play a tune here, and this was a request from somebody. This is John Prine. Come back to us.
Saw her, she was standing in the rain with her overcoat under her arm, leaning on a horsehead cane. She said, "Carl, take all the money." She called everybody Carl. My spirit's broke, my mind's a joke, and getting up's real hard. Don't you know how when you see her, she grew up in your backyard. Come back to us, Barbara Lewis, Hare Krishna Beauregard. Bibles at the airports, buying quidditch on the phone. And you talk about a paper route, she's a shut-in without a home. God save her, please, she's nailed her knees to some drugstore parking lot. Hey, Mr. Brown, turn the volume down, I believe this evening shot. Don't you know how, if you see her, she grew up in your backyard. Come back to us, Barbara Lewis, Hare Krishna Beauregard. Picture her next Thursday. Can you picture her as ball in the Hotel Boulderado at the dark end of the hall. I gotta shake myself and wonder why she even bothers me. For if heartaches were commercial, we'd all be on TV. Don't you know how, when you see how she grew up, yeah, your backyard, come back to us, Martha Lewis, Hare Krishna, au regard. Krishna,
all right, welcome back, listeners. This hour of Fane of the Cosmos is brought to you by El Taco Mexican Restaurant. And these are some of the kindest people on the planet. I can't tell you how many times I've been picked up hitchhiking by the beautiful people who own El Taco Mexican Restaurant. And my son today would have eaten there if he had had his way. He loves the burritos there. So if you can, support those folks, because they're always doing good works in the community, and they love community radio. And if you love community radio and you don't have a membership, get one now. It's crucial. It's crucial that we have community radio in this time of media concentration. So we're back. And by the way, that was John Prine, that last song. So we've been talking about we've just been leading up. Now we're going into the deep psychology part of things, like the part of the discussion. The discussion of psychology and stuff doesn't have to have any judgment to it, really. You know what I mean? It's not...
There's no judgment at all,
Dustin.
There's
no judgment. It's just the study of the mechanisms of thought and...
Well, psychology, right? If we go with the etymology of psychology, the word psychology, psyche is the soul. You know, this is a Greek term for the soul, and it's really the science of the soul. Mm-hmm. So science really is obviously trying to be impartial and to impartially witness and make observations and draw hypotheses, and then do experiments to see if those hypotheses, you know, are verified through experience. You know, so we just gain knowledge is the goal. It's not, it's not driven by an ideological, framework.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's hear it.
Well, you know, I've been studying Jungian psychology, and he was really the father of depth psychology. It's being more and more recognized by many different branches of science that Carl Jung really stands in the same kind of towering way that in his discovery of the unconscious, the collective unconscious, and the tenets of depth psychology. It's equal to, you know, the discovery of quantum physics, microbiology, you know, in its impact. Mm-hmm. And, he had a lot to say about what happens, you know, when, you know, groups form and when mythologies are taken on, particularly in orthodox situations and where mythologies start becoming literalized. In other words, you know, if myths are normally interpreted in a way that's metaphorical, they have metaphorical value and potency. It means they have multiple meanings, and they bring huge amounts of information in short bites, you know. But when we the idea of fundamentalist religious belief is that the myth is brought down to a literal level. So all the mythic statements, like Jesus was born of a virgin, or that he rose bodily from the dead, you know, anything that seems miraculous, and all myths have miraculous components to them, you know, the risen from the dead, coming together after being dismembered, and the resurrections, and they all have these kind of myths. Every true lineage that I've studied has very, very similar components.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's ways to understand them that are metaphors to the processes that we go through as human beings, when we're evolving, we're maturing, and we're growing, and we're fulfilling our potential.
That's an indicator of the commonality of our consciousness in the fact that these myths are so connected through a variety of cultures.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, like Jung said, myths are populated by archetypal figures. Those are the characters of myths. They're archetypes. I mean, in Christianity, they call them the archangels. Now, we all have our personal angel, you know, but there are archangels, and those correspond to archetypes as well. And so, you know, when you have an archetypes, you know, if we give a definition to it, they are primal patterns of meaning. Primal. They're at the foundation of our psyche, all right? And they're patterns. So there's a way that they kind of unfold, and they have meaning to them, and they affect our behavior. They affect human behavior. They affect the behavior of the communities. So, and of course, it's generally the mature practitioners, you know, the priests, the shamans, the elders, and so on of these traditions, that through their experience, through their own enlightenment and spiritual maturity, are able to help the younger ones, you know, interpret and receive those myths and have it, you know, have them grow with their individual experience. Mm-hmm. So there's this kind of balance between there's the individual who's evolving and finding his fulfillment and his spiritual realization, but within the context of a community. This is a beautiful thing, and it requires myth. You know, a common myth to that people in order to achieve that end.
It's almost like myth helps the person mature without experience. Like myth helps nurture those primal roots so the person's consciousness can evolve even without them having to have so many experiences in life that backs it up.
I think it gives them a framework so they're able to understand it. They're able to see it like a map for themselves, and they see where they are on the map, where they're going, that kind of thing.
Well, and it's also a conduit for and a framework to be able to understand mystic and revelatory experience. Mm-hmm. Because anyone who's pursuing a real spiritual path with sincerity is going to be coming in contact with the archetypes. They're going into their own, what Jung called the personal unconscious. So those are all the layers in the psyche that we're not conscious of. They aren't part of our ego and our persona, but they're nonetheless influencing us in very big ways. And I'd like to say that, you know, Carl Jung, and along with Freud, but as an evolution of Freud, discovered within the psyche what he called autonomous complexes. You know, and I'm going to give a brief description of that. Autonomous is self-ruling, self-governing, self-willing, self-determining. So within our own psyche are autonomous complexes, and the complexes are energetic fields of psychic material that are accumulating repressed stuff that we want to repress and we don't want to look at. So we don't want to deal with it, it gets shoved down there. And that complex builds and builds and builds in terms of an energetic field until, in its own autonomy, it will overpower ego consciousness. Then we're starting to describe a person who's in a dissociated state, because he hasn't dealt with this material in a conscious way. He's repressed too much. It turns neurotic, dissociative, there's other words for it, and his behavior starts to become chaotic, erratic, and dissociated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So is this a good time for you to talk about your experience in 2 weeks there?
Yeah, I think I'm kind of setting up where I'm going to go with it, you know, because really, again, I really want to say that what this group, the 12 tribes, I think that they bring is for many people, it can be a very good thing. You know, it's a home for people who have lost, you know, lost their footing in our culture, and our culture has many big problems. It gives, you know, community, friendship, sense of brotherhood, sisterhood, and a purpose. They get good work. There's food to eat, and they celebrate. This provides a context that's really healthy for a lot of people who really, prior to that, you know, would readily admit that they were lost.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as I tell this story, I also want to say that there's an aspect of it that I think a person needs to be aware of, particularly people who value their individual freedom, who value the idea that it's my inherent right, it's a God-given right, or it's just a basic inalienable human right that I should be able to fulfill my potential. My potential as a spiritual, psychological, and physical being. That, you know, all the gifts of nature are given freely to one and all, and that kind of freedom is just indispensable for realization and for enlightenment. For those individuals who are on that kind of path, they need to ask the hard questions before joining a group. You know, one needs to know that if you're going to be part of that group, that that group will honor that kind of freedom that the individual needs to have in order to fulfill their potential.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, so what I'd like to do is I'd like to tell the story, the 2 week story.
Okay.
Because I hadn't decided to join the 12 tribes. And the way it came about is I had a breakdown in a vehicle. I was traveling to the coast and I ended up coming back on a bus. And, you know, there were several different complications in my life around my family and, you know, my film project. And, you know, you're in the challenging times, let's say.
Yeah.
And I showed up in Nelson late and I immediately went over to their restaurant. And, you know, I know everybody and we're quite friendly. And they invited me to stay at the community inn that night, which is just down the block. So, you know, I took them up on that and thought, great, you know, I don't have any way to get home out to the land, and my friends here are going to put me up. Awesome, you know. Now, the next morning, it turned out that one of their the people that was working in the restaurant was ill, and they were talking at the table about how they needed to try and find someone to fill in. So I thought, well, gee, you know, I'm here, and, you know, why not? I can help you folks out, and I'd like to do that. So, you know, I helped them out that day, and of course, we're back into our nice, friendly thing, and then they invited me out to come out to the land. I was a bit surprised because I knew they knew about my own spiritual beliefs, and we had had some really quite heated, you know, discussions. So I was kind of surprised that they were so willing to, you know, bring me out to their farm again. I thought that we'd maybe gotten over that. But, you know, I thought, well, here's another opportunity, and maybe they're opening up as well, you know, and... you know, by this point, after 4 years of discussions and hearing the sort of rhetorical stuff of their dogma, you know, their doctrine,
yeah,
which is we have the truth and we are the chosen ones and so on, and all the, you know, all the self, you know, glorifying accolades that I was hearing. And of course, I argued strenuously that, no, they're not the only ones, you know, that have the truth, but maybe they've got a piece of it, you know, and it could be very valuable. I knew from my study of depth psychology and Jungian psychology that somewhere in there is hidden the shadow. We all have it. Everyone has a personal shadow, and every group has a collective shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And every religious group has a very large shadow going on. And the tendency, of course, that Jung discovered is because we're not seeing our shadow, we inevitably project it on to the other person over there. You know, so Christianity, of course, sees Islam. They see their own shadow in Islam, but they really think it's over there in Islam.
You need a shadow.
You do need a shadow, but you also need to look at it.
Yeah.
Okay, because this is the thing in Jungian psychology, is to grow and to mature as an individual is to take the responsibility to look at your shadow, to face it, to take responsibility for it, and throw the light of consciousness on it, and that's what transforms the shadow. It integrates it, it assimilates it, and it becomes a useful component of your psyche rather than an autonomous complex that'll get you when you're not paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, you know, it's one thing to have someone's personal shadow foisted onto you. It doesn't feel good. And is, you know, it's often the cause for some fisticuffs. But to have a collective shadow projected onto you is another experience altogether.
So you were making mate that day? Did you get in there or what?
Like, boy, they got good mate over there. You know, that definitely hooked me in.
Did you see the preserved seed? One of Moses' testicles hanging in a jar full of formaldehyde? No, not.
They didn't show that part.
Okay, not that deep.
No, we didn't go that deep right away.
Okay.
I started staying over there, and I thought, you know, here's a real opportunity. I'm gonna take this opportunity. I have some time. I want to really find out, you know, once and for all, what's going on behind the scenes. I want to get down to what really goes on in here. What's really running the show? You know, is it really like what they say? Is it really equality, that we're all equal? We're all in, you know, we're all loving with each other, of course. And, you know, we're not really trying to recruit anyone, but, you know, it's like our arms are open because we're being led by Yahshua. And, which again, as I say, is the Hebrew name for Jesus. And, just losing my thought a little bit.
So your experience of your 2 weeks there, right?
You went, you made
mad. Worked in the preserved seed. Right, and yeah. Then you went out and you stayed at the farm?
Yeah. Oh, I wanted, the point that I was wanting to make is they started to describe to me more deeper elements of their mythology. And this became very interesting for me, was their idea. First of all, they subscribe very much to the Old Testament. Okay, so we're back into Genesis and Revelations and so on, right?
Yeah.
And that's really the bone, the backbone and the foundations of their mythology and what's, you know, their belief system that's driving them. And so I have a big interest in that. And then how does that correspond to the New Testament and the arrival of Jesus? And because the Jews, and like which is really where they're coming from with the Old Testament, they don't believe that Jesus was the Messiah. This is the problem right now between the Jews and the Christians, yeah. You know, is, and the Christians say, no, he was the Messiah, and the second one's going to be showing up right away. And, of course, the Jews are saying, no, the first one hasn't come yet.
And the Muslims say, no, we have the second one here. It's Muhammad.
Yeah, right? And so all three of them are constellating. They're all coming. They're desert religions. Their mythologies come from the same geographical, environmental area. It's a sky god. It's patriarchal, right? And it's...
Same book.
And it's the same book that they're same all book. Dealing with, right?
Same book.
Yeah. Nice, but there's one. But there's slightly... And so there's slightly different aspects of the mythology. Well, each one, you know, because they tend towards, once it's orthodox, once it's gone into, which is really bringing it into the political field, I mean, Rome took it and they wiped out the more esoteric traditions. The Gnostics had to go, the Essenes had to go.
Cathars.
You know, I mean, the Cathars, it goes on and on. In fact, you know, once you've assumed that it is you that has the truth, that you are the chosen people of the one God, and that you, a special place has been made for you, and that the lake of fire is burning for everyone else that is not, that who may come across that and doesn't accept it, that's where they're going forever. You know, there's the power principle is enormous that happens in that group, because they are now identified with that archetype, you know. And so, in fact, what they were saying to me was, well, the second coming of Yahshua is not as one person, it's as our collective. We, as a group, are the new body. We are the new Yahshua. Wow. I'm going, okay, this...
Really?
Yeah. This is tremendously interesting, though, to me. You know, that we're no longer talking about a single incarnation, we're talking about a multiple incarnation. So Christ was an individual, and his life, Jesus, Yahshua, you know, was really a profound symbol of someone who lived his life in impeccable honesty, impeccable connection with the divine, and with his divine destiny as an individual,
yeah.
Okay? But
yeah.
Now he's coming back as a collective, and they're saying, and we are that body, and so we have that same authority. So I'm going, okay... You know, so each one of you has that authority, and you're saying you're all equal, so it's all spread out in some kind of egalitarian way. And now I'm going to start watching for this, because it's not looking that way to me right now, and I need to take a really good look at this. You know, now the 2 weeks is going by. I went in there, first of all, saying, you know, making it clear that I'm not joining your tribes right away. You know, I'm in here, I'm your friend. They were acknowledging that. I said to them, you know, I'm working on a film, and I've made commitments to that film, and I need to complete that film before I could even begin to consider, you know, joining your group, because people have invested, I've given my word, and it's my integrity. That was, you know, acknowledged and perfectly fine, and I also, you know, described to them my I had some health issues because I've got some a certain type of arthritis, and I have a disintegrated disc, and so I have a very particular diet, you know, that I got from the Ann Wigmore Institute. It's a live food diet. And I started sharing that. You know, we were having really wonderful conversations.
About wheatgrass and Christian guy who was cast out to eat in the pastures.
Well, I mean, it's actually very much an Essene diet. I mean, the Essenes were on to all that about how to purify the body and become a clean vessel, right? You know, just as it helps to also receive the higher kind of inspirations that come about, you know?
Yep.
If you have a clean vessel, you receive things in a clean way.
So you were... It clear that you weren't ready to jump then.
No, I know, and I wasn't. But I really loved the idea that they had community. I know that things need to change in our culture. We need to articulate a new paradigm, and that's what I feel my destiny is all about. My life is about that. I've seen where this culture and this paradigm are going, along with many others, and in the deep ecology movement, in the depth psychology movement, in the quantum physicist movement, and so on. So it's imperative, you know, to really find these answers. And if this group has even a key, even something that aids in that process, of then I'm interested and I want to know. Mm-hmm. And I would like to receive that, you know. So
again, what was the experience, huh?
Yeah. So the first week was, I was spending a lot of time with the younger people, you know, at lunches and while we're working and we're having our discussions. And really, they're really a sweet group of people, and they're sincere, and we were having really nice talks. They appreciated me. I appreciated them. And things were going along really well. I was sharing with them these ideas of how to cleanse and how to heal in certain ways, and also I was sharing with them my experiences in other lineages, because I've been involved with other lineages because my own lineage allows that, and I've seen that all of them, the ones who were enlightened, all were giving the same message. They were all had the same principles intact, and were recognized by their disciples, and so they were giving really the same universal message. You know, we're all brothers and sisters. We're all in this together. We all have the potential to become realized. That's a very important one. Not in the afterlife, in this life.
Yes.
You know, yeah. Enlightenment is available if you're ready to do the hard work, you know, and the disciplines that it requires to get there, and you have the right context and teachers and so forth. So I was sharing that with them, and they found that quite fascinating, although it goes against, of course, their tenets. So they were, you know, struggling with that a lot and wanted to say, well, yeah, but no one was like Jesus. And I'd say, yeah, well, some of these, all these other groups say that too. Well, no one was like Muhammad, and no one was like Confucius, and no one was like Buddha. And no, we really have the truth. I know looks like you got it, but we really have it. You know, honestly, in our day and age, I believe we've got to get over that.
Yeah, exhausted the mono megalomania. Like,
megalomania. Yeah, we're going there in this conversation. So, to continue my story, the elder men in the tribe that are really their leaders, they call themselves, they're the shepherds, and really the younger ones and the upcoming ones are the sheep. That's also metaphorical, all right? And they weren't really participating with me very much. I kind of noticed they weren't saying much to me at first, and it was just like really brief encounters. But later on, I realized that they were finding, you know, they were asking what I was talking about and kind of finding out about what I was doing in there when I wasn't present, and kind of getting more of a take on me and what was going on. And I could in the second week I could see agitation going on, you know, with a couple of the elders, and one of the fellow Isaac, you know, approached me and he said, so you know, you're going along with the film. He said, you know, to be here, you know, you're going to really have to give that up. And I said, well, gee, Isaac, you know, I talked to you last week and I told you that I was doing the film and you said that was fine and to complete it. And he goes, well, that was last week. This is this week. You know, so those were his exact words. And I, you know, I kind of looked off and I thought, okay, now, so what you're telling me this week is not going to apply to next week. You know, I guess the equation is that whatever you're saying may hold validity for about 7 days. And then it no longer holds validity. So how am I to put any, you know, long-term plans into this? You know, the most I could possibly do is think in terms of a week with you guys at this point, yeah. Right? I mean, it only seems sensible, right? You know, I said last week it was okay, and this week it isn't, right? So,
what do you think he was saying in that, really?
Well, he was indicating to me that really, you've got to give up everything here, you know, and you know, you might have given your word and, you know, other people did this and they're counting on you, but you're giving up everything of your old life and, you know, because they're not part of the truth and you aren't yet either, it really doesn't matter because, you know, just it's in the same way that the Christians have gone out and conquered and oppressed and obliterated and genocided, you know, native traditions all over the planet because they think that they're the only ones that are right. They're the ones who are saved and every, you know, so who cares about where the other ones are going? They're in Satan's realm. You know, we might as well dispatch them into the lake of fire now because that's where they're going anyway.
Yeah.
As much as Christianity has had that history and we all know it. So, you know, not that Isaac was articulating that exactly, but he was saying to me, you know, you're going to have to be giving things up if you want to be part of this. Well, I started, you know, having problems around that, you know, because first of all, I couldn't just quite subscribe to the idea that any one group's got the whole truth. That I wasn't about to really give in to that anyway. But I was having this wonderful experience, you know, and they're doing wonderful things. You know, they got the farm, they're living together.
You enjoyed working on the farm.
I enjoyed working with them and so on, and I was feeling like I'd really like to just play this out to the end. But
what cut it short?
Well, so at the end of the second week, and then I was, Shalom was there, and he's one of the elders. He's about a 60-year-old man, had been a former professor and poet. And I had some conversations with him, and one day I began to tell him about, we were talking about healing and so on, and I told him about my friend in Vancouver who's a homeopathist, and he just cut me off and he said, I'm not interested in anybody's, you know, in man's life is garbage. And I was in shock. At that moment I went, what? You know? And I said, well, I mean, how can you say that? I mean, what about, you know, someone like Mother Teresa? I mean, she's not part of your tribe, but I'm not interested in anything because it's everybody's life that isn't acknowledging Yeshua, you know, the way we are. It's just a garbage life. It's a worthless, useless, you know? And here I was witnessing, you know, an arrogance that really is born of an identification with an archetype. You know, you are convinced that you've got the truth and everyone else is either going to come up to the mark or it's sayonara, you know. And that's when I realized now I'm starting to see the shadow.